I'm Dave Laird.
I'm Matt Booker.
And I'm Jim Gower, preparing to make an infinite series of grand entrances into pocket after pocket of space here in the great concavity.
Jim, that's
see if you
one.
Can spot that one.
Oh my gosh, I don't.
Page 571. No,
is that from Wallace's philosophy thesis, Fate, Time, and Language, or something?
No, in fact, it's Tony Krause. Poor Tony.
Oh yeah.
Tony. After he's had the seizure and he's thinking back on the sort of grand entrances that stars would make in 1950s movies.
Oh yeah.
And he's not feeling so this is after he's been in the Armenian library bathroom stall.
Right.
Had the seizure on the bus, and then he's moving on, as we know, not towards a particularly pleasant ending, but the that description of poor Tony with the boa wrapped around him, making an infinite series of grand entrances. Was just, for me, it was both an example of the strange poetry of Wallace's prose, because it's there's no ornament at all. There's no sense that he's trying to write something poetic. He's just, the language itself is just sings. And the rhythm of it is beautiful. And it's also an example for me of this almost mystical ability of Wallace to take a otherwise completely unsalvageable human being and make the character empathetic. Yes. I mean, I think poor Tony is for one of the characters that's not at the center of the book is just fascinating, because in some ways, you know, his character arc is just straight down.
And, it's like pure objection.
At the same time, he has this kind of heroic quality of, he just keeps going, you know, and however bad it gets, it's just, okay, on to the next thing. And and poor Tony is my wife's favorite side character. So it's a bit of an homage to Meredith. So,
so our guest today is Jim Gower. And as you can tell, Jim, we're going to give you a little bit of introduction and then get back to this, because last we emailed, I think you said you had not read Infinite Jest while you were writing the book. So now that you clearly have, I might have to revise my questions for you.
And I guess we should introduce what book you've written, Jim. But listeners of our show have definitely heard your name before if they've listened in the last 10 or so episodes, because we've talked about your book, Novel Explosives, quite a lot on the show. And Matt and I have both thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed it and promoted it as much as we can on this show.
And I feel
start
like
to the bio.
of all the books, and I will say this at right from the top, that says of all the books that we have promoted on the show, I think that yours is the best, or and deserves the most attention that it hasn't gotten. I feel like anyone who is a literate reader, who's a fan of literary fiction and especially sprawling novels, which most people listen to this podcast are.
They're pretty down with that.
Then they would like your book. So I want more people to know about it. I want more people to discover it.
Yes.
And more people to read it. And it's really an honor to be able to talk to you about it here today.
Well, I'm really grateful, guys. I mean, we're not in a period where these kind of big, difficult novels are particularly popular in the sort of corporate publishing world that we seem to be living in. I mean, it's not that there aren't a lot of great novels that I've read over the last years, but the kind of, you know, writing and reading as an extreme sport is is not that popular these days. So, yeah. So,
well, I mean, Wallace is at the forefront of that, and part of the reason why that sort of idea of literary genius that manifests itself in long novels is often grouped together with a white male sensibility.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, that is definitely an either outmoded or outdated or on the way out point of view. And so there's a big controversy within Wallace studies of a professor at Yale, Amy Hungerford, who straight up refuses to read Wallace. And one of her reasons is basically that idea of, she just resents the idea of like, oh, a genius, and it's some white guy who wrote a long novel. And that to me is, I don't want to go down that path too far, but like,
yeah.
I think that it really causes you to miss out on a lot of great books if that's true. I mean,
yeah, well, like, you know, if you go back a bit into some of the books that really influenced me on novel explosives, you know, somewhere near the top of the list is George Eliot's Middlemarch, and Daniel Deronda. I mean, the ability to write these, you know, long periodic sentences that don't seem to be going anywhere and then land exactly where they're supposed to. This is not a white male thing. I mean, it's a style of writing that some enjoy or don't enjoy, but I'm not sure it should be for gender specific reasons. There are a lot of great female writers, and I mean, I probably have as influences more female and I would say non-white influences than anyone.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, actually, if I could interrupt, because at the beginning of the book, you know, there's a lot going on with Pessoa and, mm-hmm. you know, the different identities that are popping up. But by the end of the book, I thought, wow, this guy's clearly read Gravity's Rainbow.
Yeah, totally.
a couple of times.
And a great deal of world literature as well, yeah.
Well, of course, you're going to get me right back into trouble talking about white male authors.
Sure.
Yeah. No, certainly. I mean, that whole string, you know, with Gaddis and Gass, and I mean, Joseph McElroy, who I don't think people read too much anymore, but
Women and Men, right?
Women and Men, Lookout Cartridge, some of the, you know, great big extreme fictions of the 70s and 80s and so forth, Gaddis and so on. You know, these were all sort of heroes of mine when I was at the time a poet, but reading a lot of novels. So yeah, Gravity's Rainbow was, you know, is certainly a touchstone. But, you know, I'd go back for the tradition that these land in, you sort of go back. I mean, you probably go back to Cervantes, but mm-hmm. in fact, Steve Moore could probably take you all the way back to the, you know, Hellenic novels that are the precursors. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I want to come back to that, but I realize now we haven't really summarized the novel.
Yeah, and I was going to say.
just got a little off track on your biography, which I also want to come back to.
Yeah.
I think that the book, there's probably a really short synopsis that doesn't do it justice. And I feel like any, you know, lengthy 500, 600, 700 page novel is difficult to summarize. But
sure.
Dave, do you want to try to summarize it?
Yeah, I'll give it a shot. So we have here a book that sort of has three strands, I would say. The first begins with a man waking up in Mexico and has no idea who he is or anything about his own personal history, but he has a great deal of knowledge about the world and about culture and about poetry, etc. And then we have, contiguous to that, two kind of hired gunmen characters who are down in Juarez, Mexico, and their aims become clearer as the book goes on. And we have also a venture capitalist from California who waxes quite poetic in memoirs about a great deal of things, from wine to poetry to the Gramsci and all kinds of Marxist and post-critical theory type stuff. And as any good sort of mega novel does, these strands eventually become, I'd say, more clear throughout the novel and sort of coalesce into an ending that is, you know, satisfying and fascinating to see how all these big pieces come together at the end. So we don't want to spoil too much, but I think that's kind of a quick overview. Would you say that's reasonable, Jim?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Give you 3 stars for that.
Four out of five.
The funny thing is if you turned it into a linear narrative, the book takes place over the course of a single week in 2009.
Yeah.
The week beginning right after in Easter. The wee hours just after Easter, April 13th, 2009, and ending the following Monday. If you could do a 3-sentence linear description of the story, it's actually a fairly simple story. But the way the story gets told, which to me is always the more interesting part of a novel in any case. I tried to stick to a pretty simple story. I mean, it's a venture capitalist who gets involved in a venture capital deal that it turns out has drug money behind it. He kind of discovers that there's something weird going on with one of the investors in the deal, finally gets called, told to give his profits back, and heads down to El Paso to not so much to return the money, but really to figure out what's been going on, and kind of gets drawn into this, eventually gets hit over the head and wakes up in Guanajuato with no idea who he is. So the straight story is what's interesting about that, you know? It's on the other hand, if you move the pieces around a little bit and start with the guy waking up in Guanajuato with no idea, with his knowledge intact but no idea as to who he is, that's a somewhat more interesting place to start. And then to kind of expand on that, to get rid of the usual trope, which is the man in search of his identity. In this case, our character, who's been handed a kind of phony identity, a Scottish driver's license in the name of Alvaro de Campos, rather than being in search of his identity, he isn't want to know anything about his prior identity. He'd just as soon leave it as it is and live in Guanajuato in the moment, in just with the beauty of the world. So in some ways he's fleeing his prior identity rather than pursuing it. So anyway,
yeah,
there's a lot going on there with identity and also time and space and cosmology.
Yeah.
And like you just said, the way that the book is structured is saying something itself about the nature of time being lived backwards in a way rather than forwards.
There's more than a little Proust at the bottom of that, in case you're wondering.
I think structurally too, like there are some elements of this book that remind me of Infinite Jest in the way that things are ordered, certain things coming before others, and kind of a like it's a really fun puzzle to solve this book, I think, in a way that Infinite Jest is also a fun puzzle. And I think I haven't had a chance to reread Novel Explosives yet, but I can imagine that rereading this book would also be very deeply satisfying in the way that I find Infinite Jest to be as well. Because then you have sort of all the pieces
alone.
Oh yeah, too.